Welcome to Salvation by Grace, a broadcast ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. For more information, we invite you to visit our website at www.salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We are continuing to talk about the resurrection and the theology that's grown around the resurrection. We have formed now a good framework that we can start plugging in some of the details. So this morning, we're going to look at all four, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and their particular account of the resurrection itself, because now, like I said, we have a bit of framework to work with. Let's see how well the people who were here 2 weeks ago remember what you learned. Now, of course, if you weren't here, you didn't learn it. Perhaps you already know it, but you didn't hear me say it because it never made it to the machine. That's the Sunday that the recording didn't work. So here's a pop quiz. I know you didn't come here expecting to have to engage your brain immediately, but here's a pop quiz. There are four springtime feasts in the Old Testament. 2 weeks ago, we read through them one by one. What is the first in that series of four?
Passover.
What day of the month does Passover fall on? On a Jewish calendar?
14th of Nisan.
14th of Nisan. What time of day does Passover begin?
Sundown,
exactly. Evening. I am now writing in hieroglyphics. Passover starts at evening. The evening that becomes the 14th of Nisan is actually the evening of the 13th. Right? The very next day after Passover begins starts a week-long feast. It goes for 7 days. What is the name of that feast?
Unleavened Bread.
Feast of Unleavened Bread. Very well done in the back. Unleavened Bread starts on the 15th at evening. So it's the eve of the 14th. The first and the seventh day of that week-long feast of unleavened bread are what?
Sabbaths.
Not just Sabbaths, but
high days.
Very important. The first and seventh day are high days. Okay, now during that week-long observance of unleavened bread, somewhere in that week, regardless of what day of the week it starts on, somewhere in that week, there's going to be a first day of the week. And on the first day of the week, what feast starts?
First fruits.
So 1 day feast, first fruits. First fruits happens on the first day of the week. At what time of day?
Evening.
The evening of, and this is important, the evening of what? The evening of the Sabbath day, the weekly Sabbath, right?
Yep.
Okay, then, from that day, from first fruits, they were to count off 7 Sabbaths, and then the day after the 7th Sabbath, which would make 50 days exactly after first fruits, is the feast of?
Pentecost,
or called Feast of Weeks, because they waited those 49 days, 7 times 7, and then the Feast of Pentecost. Now, these rules, these calendar dates, these feasts, these set times of the Lord are spelled out in exacting detail in the Old Testament. And then Jesus came along. We know that he kept the Passover with his apostles. We call it the Last Supper. We'll be taking communion together here on Resurrection Sunday to continue that observance that he said to continue until he returned. On the evening of the 13th, after sundown, he was able to take the Passover meal because Passover had technically begun. During that night, he went through being shuffled back and forth between Pilate and Herod. And then by the morning, that was the morning of the 14th, still Passover day, Pilate was able to take Jesus and Barabbas in front of the crowd, who all would have been gathered there in Jerusalem for Passover. This is important to remember. Everybody was gathered in Jerusalem for Passover, and they were free to move around. They were out of their homes. They were free to continue what they were doing. But the next day, as Feast of Unleavened Bread began, the next day was a Sabbath day, a high day, which John is very careful to point out to us that the next day after Jesus' death was a high day. So the end of the 14th of Nisan also served as day of preparation, because the day before a high day always served as a day of preparation. Got all that? And then the feast began. Now, it doesn't matter what day of the week unleavened bread falls on. Unleavened bread comes after the 14th day of Nisan regardless. It's on the 15th of Nisan every year regardless. And as I told you before, the Jewish calendar is a lunar calendar that has 30 days to a month, 12 months to a year, 360 days in a year. Consequently, since we know now and count the rotation of the earth around the sun as a year, and we know that a year is 365 and a quarter days, our calendar, our solar calendar, every 4 years, we add a day to February, and February has 29 days to kind of bring the calendar around right. Well, on the lunar calendar, societies that follow the lunar calendar would do the same thing. Every 6 years, they would add a month, and that extra 30 days would bring their calendar around again. And the reason that our Easter falls on different days every year is because Easter is always the Sunday after Passover, and Passover moves every year on our calendar because we're on a solar calendar, and it is determined by a lunar calendar. And so every year, it's in early spring, and the next year, a little bit later spring, a little bit later spring, a little bit later spring. Those 6 years come around, they add the month, and it goes back to early spring, and then it's middle spring, and it's late spring. So that's why Easter keeps moving, too, because we're following that lunar Jewish reckoning for when those days would fall. The point being that it doesn't matter what day of the week Passover and unleavened bread fall on, the first day of the week during that week of unleavened bread is always the Feast of First Fruits. So the only feast in that list that falls on a particular day every single time is First Fruits. Always falls on the first day of the week, and it starts essentially Saturday night, the night of the weekly Sabbath. Got all that? Now we're going to plug in the details, because 2 weeks ago we built this whole thing in much greater detail than we did this morning so that we could just walk through it, because you can't understand the biblical accounts of all the activities that took place if you're going to say that Jesus died on a Friday, was buried Friday night, was in the tomb until Sunday morning, and then rose at sunup, especially remembering that when the women came to the tomb, he was already gone. They didn't come at sunup and then watch him rise. They came and found an empty tomb at sunup, meaning that he actually rose up out of the tomb sometime between Saturday evening and Sunday morning. And there's simply not enough time for things like the women to go buy the spices, because that Saturday that he would have been in the tomb would have been a Sabbath. So none of the Jews could have traveled. They couldn't have left their houses. There was no time for, like, the high priest to go and meet with Pontius Pilate and ask for a guard, especially when you look at their reckoning for why they needed a guard. We're going to look at that this morning. And you'll see that if you just let the details speak, there's simply no way to say that he was in the tomb Friday night, stayed there all day the Sabbath, and before sunup Sunday, he was already gone. Too many other things took place during what had to be a 72-hour period. And I say that because Jesus himself said, "A wicked and adulterous generation requires a sign to believe, and there will no sign be given to it except the sign of Jonah." And then he spells out what he means. And he says, "As Jonah was in the belly of the fish for 3 days and three nights, so the Son of Man will be in the heart of the earth for 3 days and three nights." And there's just no mathematic way to go from Friday evening to Sunday morning and get 3 days and three nights. So one of two things is true. Either Jesus was speaking in some strange form that meant 3 days, three nights in some symbolic way, but that he could go in the tomb Friday night, get up Sunday morning, and somehow fulfill that. Or he actually meant what he was saying. And I think, as we're going to see this morning, the understanding, the common understanding of what he said, even among the Jewish leaders, was that it was going to be three whole days and three whole nights. And so I contend that there's really no other way if you just let the Bible speak. There is no Good Friday in the Bible. You know that, right? There's nothing in the Bible about Good Friday or the observance of Good Friday. There's no Maundy Thursday. And I hate to break this news to anybody. There's no Mardi Gras in the Bible. Are you aware of that? There's no Ash Wednesday in the Bible. What there is 40 days of weeping over the death of Tammuz. Of course, back in the Old Testament, that is strictly prohibited and called an abomination before God. And yet it has migrated into the Christian religion as something called Lent, which is really a shameful thing because you've got these people running around with ashes on their foreheads giving up, I don't know, green beans for 40 days as if God is very, very impressed with them giving up something they didn't really like that much in the first place. And they don't even understand the history of it or where it comes from. The only place that there is a foundation for it in the Bible is when God prohibits it and says, see these women weeping over the death of Tammuz? What an abomination. And yet it has migrated into Christian culture. Yes, sir?
It does provide the basis for Lobster Fest.
For Lobster Fest. That's funny. If James was here, he would have enjoyed that, by the way. He went up.
I did.
Ah, see? The disembodied voice from another room. Okay, so you follow all this? Turn to Matthew 27. I think all these pieces are going to start to fall together much easier for you now. Matthew 27, starting at verse 57. Now, when the evening was come, what evening would that be? It says, when the evening was come in verse 57, what evening are they referring to?
The day after Passover.
Right, the beginning of the day after Passover. It's the day that Jesus was crucified, right? So Jesus was crucified on Passover day. That evening is when these events are taking place. Now, what is that evening? It's the beginning of what day?
Feast of Unleavened Bread.
It's the beginning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread is a
high day.
And so at the beginning of what would be a high day, when the evening was coming, the beginning of that high day, there came a rich man of Arimathea named Joseph, who also himself was Jesus' disciple, and he went to Pilate and he begged for the body of Jesus. Then Pilate commanded the body to be delivered. And when Joseph had taken the body, he wrapped it in a clean linen cloth and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had hewn out in a rock, and he rolled a great stone to the door of the sepulcher, and he departed. What's important about that bit of information, and you're going to see in the other three accounts as well, is the reason he put that body in the tomb right there is that it was in the same garden right next to Golgotha. So it was very, very close. Convenient to just get the body off the cross, because the next day was a high day. They didn't want the bodies to stay up through the high day, and they needed to get it in a tomb quick, so Joseph of Arimathea, who had a tomb already purchased for his own body, knew that his tomb was empty, therefore they could put the body in there quickly. Now, Golgotha is right outside the wall of Jerusalem, which means that the tomb that Jesus was laid in was also right outside the wall. The reason that's important is that it is a very known and accessible tomb. It's a findable place. You understand what I mean? But if you go to Jerusalem now and you take the Jerusalem tour, they will show you two different tombs that they think might have been the tomb that Jesus was laid in. But they don't know which one it is. You know why they don't know which tomb it is?
He's not there.
He's not in it. There's nobody in it. And because he was only in it for 3 days, history has lost which tomb it was. He was in it for such a short period of time. But if it is a known tomb and Joseph of Arimathea is a known guy who's a wealthy fellow, and you start hearing the preaching that the tomb is empty and you live there in Jerusalem and you don't like that preachment, all you have to do to disprove the preaching of the resurrection is go to the tomb. The original people who had a great deal at stake, the Romans and the Jews, who had a great deal at stake if Jesus did indeed rise. After all, he had called the Jewish leaders, he had called them a brood of vipers, said, how will you escape the fire of hell? Well, if the one who said that actually rose up again, then you might in fact actually be in danger of hellfire. So that's a big deal. If you're the Romans and you're trying to keep Caesar worship going, and this man's being called king of the Jews, and he's being called a god himself, a god man, and you've crucified him and he gets up again, well, you have a real vested interest in trying to disprove that claim. And so through history, people who have tried to undermine Christianity have tried to claim that the reason, one of the many reasons, that Christianity got a foothold was not that Jesus actually resurrected, but the women went to the wrong tomb. Sure, they found an empty tomb, but they went to the wrong tomb. And that's why I'm stressing that it was a very known tomb in a very known place that's very close by, that's very findable. Because not only then would the women have had to go to the wrong tomb, but then every one of the disciples would have gone to the wrong tomb. And there would have been, after all, guards who were stationed on the right tomb, so it wouldn't have been hard to find the right tomb. So the whole "the women went to the wrong tomb" theory just kind of falls apart. We talked about a couple of those theories last week, like the swoon theory or the Jesus the Indian magician theory. Another popular theory is the hallucination theory, that the women and the disciples, though they were very committed to what they believed, they really did believe that he had raised, but they had hallucinated. They thought he was risen. They thought they'd seen him. They thought he was in the room. They thought they had talked to him, but they had a hallucination, which can be easily exploded by Paul saying that he had been seen by Cephas, he'd been seen by the other 12. He said he'd been seen by over 500 brethren. And then Paul says, the most of whom are still alive, though a few sleep. In other words, go check with them. I have 500 witnesses. And then he said he was seen last of all by me as one born out of due time. In other words, he's saying there are a whole lot of people who all had the exact same hallucination. How do you explain that? Especially, again, as Rick pointed out last week, that there was no benefit to buying into this story. I mean, if you bought into Christianity, that was a surefire method to have your business undermined, to be thrown out of the temple, to, if you were in Rome, to have your children and your family fed to lions, or you end up in Nero's garden being a torch. All of those were the benefits of Christianity. Why did 500 people who saw no benefit to it have the exact same hallucination that Jesus raised? Well, the hallucination theory also doesn't fly. Especially, again, if it's a known and accessible tomb that everybody can get to and they all know where it is, all you have to do to explode the preaching that Jesus has raised is go to the right tomb. And if there's a body in there, then hallucinations disappear and the wrong tomb theory disappears. There's no way around it, whether it's history losing which tomb it is or finding a logical, rational explanation for why they were convinced of the resurrection, it's unavoidable that the tomb itself was empty. That's a historical reality. You can't explain the spread of Christianity or how the early preachment got the hold it did if the tomb was not, in fact, empty. Now, we can talk about theories for why the tomb was empty, but the tomb he was laid in had to be empty for Christianity to even get a foothold. Got all that? Okay. I am continuing then in verse 61. And there was Mary Magdalene and the other Mary sitting over against the sepulcher. Now, this is interesting because that means that Mary and the other Mary, who came later to anoint his body, who were there at the cross when he died, were still there at the cross when the body was taken down, and then they watched where they laid the body. So they knew which tomb it was. They knew how to get there. Verse 62. Controversial verse that we've talked about before. Now, the next day that followed, the original reading is, now the next day that followed the day of preparation, what day follows the preparation? If you're using common Jewish parlance and you say day of preparation, what's the day after a day of preparation?
Sabbath.
A Sabbath. It's always a Sabbath. Now, throughout the Bible, what is the Sabbath always called?
Sabbath.
The Sabbath, exactly. It was too obvious. Yeah. Everybody went, wow, Jim's asking a question I don't. What's the Sabbath always called? It's always, always, always called the Sabbath. Nowhere in the Bible is the Sabbath ever called the day after the day of preparation, because the day of preparation is a day subservient to the Sabbath. The Sabbath is the mark. It is the emblem. It is the token of the entire Mosaic covenant. The Sabbath is that sign that the people of God were under the Mosaic covenant, and so it is referred to as the highest, holiest day of the week, never referred to as the day after the day of preparation. And if you simply move the comma, remembering that there is no punctuation in the original Greek, the punctuation you see here was added by the translators, it just as easily reads, now the day that followed, comma, the day of preparation. And if that's the way you read it, it makes much more sense. It means that Jesus died, he was buried just as the Feast of Unleavened Bread began, and the day after was the day of preparation, which would mean the day after was Friday. It's the only day it can be. If that's the case, then you have Jesus on the cross on a Wednesday, you have the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread being a Thursday, you have the day of preparation when the women can go buy their spices, when the high priest can go and talk to Pilate and ask for a guard, which we're going to read for a moment. And then you've got Saturday, the weekly Sabbath, which would be the reason they would need a Roman guard, because they couldn't put their own guard on there because it was a Sabbath day after all. And by sundown Saturday night, Jesus then is able to come out of the tomb before sunrise Sunday. And if you just let the Bible spell that out that way, you end up with exactly 72 hours, 3 days, 3 nights. You end up with exactly what Jesus said. Now, the next day that followed, the day of preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees came together to Pilate. Of course they would come together to Pilate on the day of preparation. That's the only day they could do it, because Thursday is a high day and Saturday is a weekly Sabbath. The only day that they can come and talk to a Gentile is a Friday. And this is a huge problem, and I've had this discussion with folks who are very firmly committed to the Friday-Sunday scenario, and I've looked at that verse and said, it says right here that the high priests come and talk to Pilate, which is not allowable on the Sabbath day. And if Matthew says that Joseph of Arimathea took the body of Jesus down at evening on a Friday, that's the beginning of the Sabbath. And so nowhere during the Sabbath day do they have the opportunity to go talk to Pilate. So then they would have to go Saturday evening, but typically the Romans, who were living on a solar calendar, did business during the day. And then by Sunday morning, Jesus is up and risen. So when does this conversation take place? But the Bible, I think, is quite clear in telling us that there's a day of preparation in there. The next day that followed, the day of preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees came together to Pilate, and they said, now look at their understanding of what they think Jesus said, saying, "Sir, we remember that that deceiver," speaking of Jesus, "said while he was yet alive, 'After 3 days, I will rise again.'" Their understanding of what Jesus said was that he was going to rise after 3 days. Now look at the Friday-Sunday scenario for a moment. If he is in the tomb Friday night, that's the beginning of the first day, right? So then why would they break the Sabbath on a Saturday and go running to Pilate if they know they've got 3 days to work with? They'd wait until Sunday, the first day of the week. Except that in the Friday to Sunday scenario, too late, he's already up. So the only opportunity they have to go here is if there is a day of preparation, a Friday, when they can go and speak. And their understanding of what Jesus said was it's going to be 3 whole days. And that's a 24-hour period, 3 days, from Wednesday night to Thursday night to Friday night to Saturday night. And their concern was, it's now Friday. It's the day of preparation. It's now Friday. And he said 3 days he was going to get up, which means tomorrow night he's getting up. Our problem is, it's our Sabbath. So we can't go guard the tomb. So they go to the Romans and say, "Can you put a guard on the tomb? Because we can't do it. It's our Sabbath." Now all those pieces make sense. Saying, "Sir, we remember that that deceiver said, while he was yet alive, 'After 3 days, I will rise again.'" The Jewish understanding, the Jewish leader's understanding, was Jesus said 3 days. When he told about the sign of Jonah, he said 3 days, 3 nights. So is there any ambiguity in the Bible about how long Jesus would be in the tomb? No. It's only those Babylonish, Romish ideas of Friday to Sunday that have infiltrated Christianity that have people thinking unbiblically about what took place over that period of time that he was in the grave. But there's nothing in the Bible to restrict, and plenty in the Bible to support, the idea that he was in the grave 3 days and three nights. And we know he got up on the first day of the week at the beginning of Feast of First Fruits, so the only direction to go is to move that date of his crucifixion backwards a couple days. And if you do that, all of these days fit perfectly.
And Jim, some folks would say this 3 days, three nights is some sort of Jewish euphemism or something, because even there they sit there and say, "After 3 days, I'm going to rise again." And you could say, well, that's maybe they're using some type of, you know,
Part of Friday.
Right.
Part of Friday, that's a day. All of Saturday and part of Sunday. Yeah.
The next sentence, it says that he gives orders, the grave be made secure until the third day.
Until the third day.
We're not using this supposed
Exactly right. There's just too many problems with the Friday-Sunday scenario. Verse 63, they were saying, "Sir, we remember that that deceiver said, while he was yet alive, after 3 days I will rise again. Command, therefore, that the sepulcher be made sure, as Jeff said, until the third day, lest his disciples come by night and steal him away and say to the people that he is risen from the dead, so then the last error shall be worse than the first." So the common anti-Christian rumor that his disciples, his followers, stole the body started very, very early. Right here, the Jewish leaders were already preparing for the notion that if the tomb wasn't secured, his apostles, his disciples would come and steal the body and then start saying that what he said was true. He said he was going to rise after 3 days. Now he did rise after 3 days. They'd go and find an empty tomb and people would start believing it and then the error would just blow up. And so they were all prepared for the idea that the disciples would try to steal the body. Verse 65, Pilate said unto them, "You have your watch, go your way, make it as sure as you can." So they've got a Roman guard to go and stand in front of the tomb, and they went and they made the sepulcher sure, sealing the stone and setting the watch. Chapter 28, in the end of the Sabbath, when's that?
Saturday night,
Saturday evening. In the end of the Sabbath, as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week, came Mary Magdalene and the other Mary to see the sepulcher. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for the angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat upon it. His countenance was like lightning, and his raiment white as snow. And for fear of him, the keepers did shake and became as dead men. Last week, Alex asked that question. He said, "Well, what happened to the guard?" And I said, "God knocked him out. God put him to sleep." It says right here, they shook for fear and fell down like dead men. And the angel answered and said unto the women, "Fear ye not, for I know that you seek Jesus, who was crucified. He is not here, for he is risen, as he said. Come and see the place where the Lord lay, and go quickly and tell his disciples that he is risen from the dead, and behold, he goes before you into Galilee, and there shall ye see him. Lo, I have told you." And they departed quickly from the sepulcher with fear and great joy, and they did run and bring his disciples word. And as they were going to tell the disciples, behold, Jesus met them and said, "All hail." And they came to his feet, and they worshiped him. And Jesus said to them, "Don't be afraid. Go tell my brethren to go into Galilee, and there they will see me." Now when they were going, behold, some from the watch, that's the Roman guard, came into the city and showed the chief priests all the things that had happened. And when they were assembled with the elders, they had taken counsel and they gave a large sum of money to the soldiers, saying, "Say this, say that his disciples came by night and stole away the body while we slept. And if this come to the governor's ears, we will persuade him and secure you." So they took the money, they did as they were taught, and this saying is commonly reported among the Jews unto this day, that the disciples stole the body. So that rumor began very, very early. Yes, sir?
Well, in order to have this account of the soldiers being bribed, someone that was there that gave them the money had to have been converted and been interviewed by the apostles.
Yeah, and knew that story.
And knew the story, yeah, in order to fill in this blank.
Right, I agree with that. And remember that Joseph Arimathea was a powerful man among the Jewish community too. That story may have come from him. He may have been the person who knew it. We also know that there was another Nicodemus, we're going to find in another account, is the guy who came with Joseph of Arimathea, also a follower of Jesus and strong among the Jews. Yes?
This is a great example of the inducement theory not working.
I agree.
They saw a dead man rise and they want to make a story up. They don't fear the consequence. They don't say, "Oh, we have to believe."
Do you know what he means? He says inducement theory, and then we just give. I keep contending that if all it took for men to believe and make a choice of their own free will, all they need is adequate inducement to make that choice via their will. Alex is making the point that here you've got the soldiers coming and saying, "Here's what really happened. There was an earthquake, and an angel came down, and the stone rolled back, and we were so scared we fell down as dead men. We got up, the body's gone." And these leaders, rather than believe, even with all that inducement to believe, ended up saying, here's some money, hush it up. Tell people that the disciples stole the body, because they were very committed to that story. Disciples stole the body, very committed.
This is what the rich man said, all that had to happen.
You're exactly right. Lazarus and the rich man. The rich man had said, if one goes back from the tomb, if one rises from the dead, then my brothers will believe. And Abraham said to him, they have Moses and the prophets. If they will not hear them, they won't believe, even if one rise from the dead. Right? So much for the inducement theory. Turn over to Mark 15. Let's fill in some more blanks. Let's start at verse 42. And now, when the evening was come, this is the day that Jesus was on the cross, it's the Passover day. When the even was come, which would be the night of the 14th, the beginning of the 15th, which is the beginning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread every year, no matter what, because it was the day of preparation, that is, the day before the Sabbath. And so people have looked at Mark there and said, well, there it is right there. It's the day before the Sabbath. Clearly, that's Friday. It's always Friday. So clearly, Jesus died on a Friday, and they got his body down on a Friday, which is why it's so vitally important that John, knowing what the other three had written, adds the information that the next day was a high day, which we know it always is. The next day after the day of Passover is always a high day. Now, when even was come, because it was the day of preparation, that is, the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea, an honorable counselor, which also waited for the kingdom of God. What kingdom would he have been waiting for there? The kingdom of Israel. There was no theology yet of the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ, and there was no theology of a spiritual kingdom as a result of the resurrection. The only kingdom that he could have been referring to there was the kingdom described throughout the Old Testament. So he came and he went boldly unto Pilate and craved the body of Jesus. And Pilate marveled that he was already dead and called unto him the centurion, and he asked whether he had been any while dead or dead for a while. And when he knew of it from the centurion, he gave the body to Joseph, and he bought fine linen. And he took down the body, and he wrapped him in the linen, and he laid him in a sepulcher which was hewn out of a rock, and rolled a stone unto the door of the sepulcher. And Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, beheld where he was laid. They paid attention to where the tomb was. And when the Sabbath was past, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, went and bought sweet spices that they might come and anoint him. So when the Sabbath was past, they went and bought the sweet spices. Now, if he was in the tomb on a Friday, and if Saturday is the weekly Sabbath, when did they buy these spices? But if there is a day of preparation after the high day, before the weekly Sabbath, and they know that he's going to be in the tomb 3 days, three nights, and by Jewish reckoning, a man was not truly dead until 3 days and three nights had passed, which is why Jesus stayed away from Lazarus. When Lazarus died, Jesus stayed away 3 days, three nights until he was really genuinely considered totally dead so that no one would question that miracle. And so they, knowing that another day, another Sabbath was going to pass, and then they could go on that day of preparation, that Friday would have gone and bought those spices. But in the Friday to Sunday scenario, there's no room for them to do that. When the Sabbath was past, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, had bought sweet spices that they might come and anoint him. And very early in the morning, the first day of the week, there's no question about what day of the week it was, they came unto the sepulcher at the rising of the sun, and they said unto themselves, who shall roll away the stone from the door of the sepulcher? And when they looked, they saw that the stone was rolled away, for it was very great. And entering into the sepulcher, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, clothed with a long white garment, and they were afraid. And he said unto them, be not afraid. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, which was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. Behold the place where they laid him. But go your way, tell his disciples and Peter, that he goes before you into Galilee. There shall you see him, as he said unto you. And they went quickly, and they fled from the sepulchre, for they trembled and were amazed. Neither did they say anything to any man, for they were afraid. And when Jesus was risen, early the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had cast seven devils. And she went, and she told them that had been with him, as they mourned and they wept. And they, when they heard that he was alive and had seen of her, did not believe. Verse 12 says, after that he appeared in another form unto two of them as they walked and went into the country. That's the Emmaus Road account, which Luke is going to pick up and tell us about. We'll get to that next week. And they went and they told it to the residue, and none of them believed. That's interesting that none of them believed. Now, here's another internal indication of the fact that the men who wrote these books, who actually experienced these things, who actually witnessed these things, were honorable, credible witnesses. And we lose this sense here in the 21st century in a more equal rights type of society. But first century Judaism, how many rights did women have? Yeah, that'd be like none. Yeah. Women could not even testify in court because women were not considered credible witnesses. And yet you've got Jesus saying to women, go and tell my disciples and Peter. The angel told women, go and tell disciples. They've been told by an angel and by the risen Lord to go and tell the disciples. Now, think for a moment with me. If these guys were liars, they've stolen the body, they know they're liars, they know they're making up a story, and they want people to buy into the story, there's no better way to do damage to your story than to say the first people who saw it, witnessed it, and testified to it were women. That's a great way to undermine your entire account. If you're lying about it and you're making up a story, you're going to say, and then we went, we men, who can be trusted on these things, we went and we saw the tomb and we saw the risen Lord and he talked to us and we spoke to the angels and we believed instantly. We understood everything he was telling us and we're firmly committed. None of that. Instead, what the accounts all say is, he appeared to women, the women were told to tell the apostles, and the apostles didn't believe it. Now, that just rings of honesty. That just rings of an actual account by actual men saying, look, this is the way it went down. This isn't pretty and it doesn't look good for us, but this is how it actually happened. The women were going there to anoint the body. We were behind locked doors weeping and moaning. We were crying and feeling bad over the death of him, and probably there was a certain amount of just this letdown of, wow, we were following him thinking he was Messiah, and now he's dead, and the whole movement's dead, and woe is us. And the women burst into the room and say, we've been to the tomb, we've talked to an angel, and he has risen, and we were told by him and the angel to come tell you that he has risen and go into Galilee, and he's going to meet you there. You can see why they would go, no. No, we don't think so. So they take off themselves to the tomb to check it out for themselves because the last thing they're going to do is believe a woman. But that really undermines the account if this is the account and story made up by liars. They would have left all that out. Turn over to Luke. Luke 23, turn over there. Luke is going to recount much the same information with a couple of extra details, and I really would like to get to at least John's account this morning to show you one last great piece of imagery that John includes here. So, starting at verse 50 of Luke 23. Behold, there was a man named Joseph, a counselor, and he was a good man and a just man. The same had not consented to the counsel and the deed of them. See there, that answers your question about, Mike, about somebody on the inside. Joseph Arimathea was part of the council and on the inside. So he would have known some of that insider information you were mentioning. He was of Arimathea, a city of the Jews, who also himself waited for the kingdom of God. This man went unto Pilate, and he begged the body of Jesus. And he took it down and wrapped it in linen and laid it in a sepulcher, which was hewn in stone, wherein never a man before was laid. And the day was the preparation, and the Sabbath drew on. And the women also, which were with him from Galilee, followed after, and they beheld the sepulcher and how his body was laid. So these women were very specific in knowing where the body was. And they returned, and they prepared spices and ointments. They rested on the Sabbath day according to the commandment. Now upon the first day of the week, very early in the morning, they came to the sepulcher, bringing the spices which they had prepared, and certain others with them. And they found the stone rolled away from the sepulcher, and they entered in, and they found not the body of the Lord Jesus. And it came to pass, As they were much perplexed thereabout, behold, two men stood by them in shining garments. And as they were afraid, they bowed down their faces to the earth. And they said unto them, Why do you seek the living among the dead? He is not here, but he is risen. Remember how he spoke unto you when he was yet in Galilee, saying, The Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified, and the third day rise again. And they remembered his words. And they returned from the sepulchre, and they told all these things unto the 11 and to the rest. It was Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Mary, the mother of James, and other women that were with them, which told these things to the apostles. And their words seemed to them as idle tales. And they, the apostles, believed not. Then arose Peter, and he ran unto the sepulchre, and stooping down, he beheld the linen clothes laid by themselves, and he departed, wondering in himself at what had come to pass. So you remember that Joseph of Arimathea had this clean white linen that he wrapped Jesus in, and all that was left there was the linen clothing. And John's going to tell us that the napkin, or the piece that they put over his face, was actually folded up and laid aside, which is just so interesting to me, that after rising from the dead, the last thing he would do is take that burial napkin and just set it aside like, well, that's done. I love that image.
Completeness.
Yeah, that's, I'll just put that right there. Starting then at verse 13 is the story of the Emmaus Road, and we'll get to that. Turn to John. Next week, we'll look at the Emmaus Road account. John 20. John 19, verse 31, is where John is specific to tell us that the day after Passover, the day that Jesus was on the cross, was in fact a high day, the first day of unleavened bread, as it would naturally be. Verse 31 says, The Jews therefore, because it was the day of preparation, that the body should not remain upon the cross on the Sabbath day, for that Sabbath day was a high day. So now you know that the day after Jesus' death on the cross was not a weekly Sabbath, it was a high day Sabbath. But as we know from the Jewish calendar, it would have been. It was every year. Starting then at verse 38, we pick up the parallel account from the other three that after this, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews, besought Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate gave him leave, and he came therefore and took the body of Jesus. And there was also Nicodemus, which at the first came to Jesus by night, and he brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pound weight. Then took they the body of Jesus, they wound it in linen clothes with the spices, as the manner of the Jews is to bury. And in the place where he was crucified, which is Golgotha, there was a garden in that same spot, and in that garden a new sepulchre wherein never a man was laid. So now you know that the tomb was right next to Golgotha, and so it was very convenient to just get that body in there before sundown. When the high day would start, they had to hurry up and get that body into the tomb before the even fell and before the next day of that week began. Verse 42. There laid they Jesus therefore because of the Jews' preparation day, for the sepulchre was close at hand. Chapter 20 starts, The first day of the week cometh Mary Magdalene early, when it was yet dark, unto the sepulchre, and she saw the stone taken away from the sepulchre. So on the first day of the week, no matter how early she went, all accounts indicate that she was there before sunrise, but did she come and see Jesus raise?
No,
she came and found an empty tomb. She came and found the rock rolled back. She came and found that many things had already been accomplished. In other words, the whole concept of Easter sunrise service is again just Roman dogma that has made its way into the popular Christian culture, because nowhere in the Bible does it say that he rose Sunday morning. The women came to the tomb on Sunday morning and found an empty tomb. So, like I always say, come to GCA Easter, sleep late. Better deal. The first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came early when it was yet dark unto the sepulchre. She saw the stone rolled away. Then she ran and she came unto Simon Peter and to the other disciple who Jesus loved, who would have been whom?
John.
Would have been John, the one who is writing this to us. And he said unto them, They have taken away the Lord out of the sepulchre, and we don't know where they have laid him. Peter therefore went forth and that other disciple, and they came to the sepulcher. So they both ran together, and the other disciple did outrun Peter and came first to the sepulcher, which I think is kind of funny that John would say, but I ran faster. Verse 5, and he, stooping down and looking in, saw the linen clothes lying, yet he did not go in. Then came Simon Peter following him, and he went into the sepulcher, and he saw the linen clothes lying and the napkin that was about his head, not lying with the linen clothes, but wrapped together in a place by itself, which is just interesting. Then went in also the other disciple, which came first to the sepulcher, which would have been John. So John is saying, I'm an eyewitness to this stuff. I was there. I was in the sepulcher. I'm telling you the truth. I'm an honest witness of things I actually beheld. But look at this. Then went in the other disciple, which came first to the sepulcher, and he saw and he believed, for up until then, or for as yet, they did not understand the scripture that he must rise again from the dead. How many times did Jesus say that to them while he was walking and talking with them? How many times did he tell them that he was going to be given into the hands of the Gentiles, he was going to be killed, and he was going to rise again? And here's John yet again saying, and we had no idea what he was talking about. Just no concept. Proof again that you can stand in front of a person who doesn't have the Holy Spirit of God in them. Forget you can stand in front of them. Jesus, the very incarnate Word of God, stood in front of them and told them the truth, and they still had no capacity to understand it because the Holy Spirit had not yet fallen. That's exactly why they didn't get it. Until the Holy Spirit came and enlightened them, they didn't understand these things he was telling them. Yes?
That would also indicate that the apostles would have no reasons to go back and steal the body, since they didn't even realize that he was supposed to be raising from the dead anyway.
That's exactly right. That's also the reason that the hallucination theory doesn't work, is that they had no expectation. They would only have hallucinated something they expected to have happen, but the consistent account is they thought it was over. Right. Yes?
The Jewish account of two witnesses bearing truth is not true until two witnesses.
Right. So
that's interesting here that John brings that out and the other three don't.
Right, that both Peter and John would have been together witnessing to it. That would have been an adequate witness, exactly. So Peter then went forth. This is chapter 20, let's start at verse 10. Then the disciples went away again unto their own homes, but Mary stood outside at the sepulcher weeping. And as she wept, she stooped down and she looked into the sepulcher. And she sees two angels in white sitting, the one at the head and the other at the feet, where the body of Jesus had been laid. The fact that John took the time to not only point out that there were two angels, but what their physical positioning was, is really, really interesting, because to any Jew who understood the history of Mosaic worship, that was a very, very powerful symbol. Because on the Ark of the Covenant, which is inside the holiest place, the Holy of Holies, the place where the high priest would go once a year to make atonement, there was a covering on that ark, on that golden box. That covering is called the kapparath in Hebrew. It's translated the mercy seat in several places in the Bible, especially in the King James. Mercy seat is a translation of the Greek word hilasterion. It also has to do with propitiation, the place where atonement takes place. And so every year the high priest would slay a spotless, unblemished animal and then would go into the holiest place and then would pour the blood of that sacrifice onto the mercy seat. And he had to pour it between two angels that sat on the mercy seat. There were two golden sculpted angels on top of the mercy seat, and their wings wrapped around either side so that they were touching, so that they encircled the place where atonement was made. You get that picture? And every year the high priest would have to come in and atone for God's people, Israel. But during the time of Jeremiah, the Ark of the Covenant and all the other furniture of the temple essentially disappears around the same time Jeremiah disappears. And by the time Hezekiah is taken into captivity and the temple is destroyed, the Ark of the Covenant essentially disappears which is why Steven Spielberg could make movies like The Raiders of the Lost Ark. The Ark has been lost, which means that the temple that was extant during the time that Jesus was walking and talking, which was the temple that Herod had built, even though it had a holy of holies, a holiest place, it was missing the most important piece of furniture that is required for that to be the holiest place. Because in Exodus, God told Moses that the mercy seat between the two cherubim was the place where God would come down and meet with the high priest. The presence of God appeared over the mercy seat, over the hilasterion between the two angels, at the place where the blood flowed, at the place where atonement was made. But inside Herod's temple, there was a holy of holies that did not have a mercy seat inside it. And then the women enter the place where Jesus was, and John takes the time to say, and the angels were positioned at either end of the place where Jesus laid, which would have made any Jew think of the mercy seat. And at the same moment, God ripped open the curtain of the temple and showed that it was empty. There's no mercy seat in here, there's no atonement in here, and there's no propitiation in here. It's just an empty temple that doesn't have the ability to atone. But outside the walls, outside the camp of Jerusalem, there are two angels standing by the place where Christ had laid, and that's the place now where atonement happens. That's the place where propitiation was made. Christ is now the mercy seat. See that picture? And it's wonderful that at the same time God created that image, he ripped open the curtain and went, look, it's empty. It's over here. This is where atonement is. This is where propitiation's made. It's great imagery. So verse 12, two angels in white sitting, the one at the head and the other at the feet where the body of Jesus had been laid. I just think that John went through so much trouble to describe that, that he wanted us to get that image. And they said unto her, woman, why do you weep? And she said, because they have taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they have laid him. And when she had said that, she turned herself back, and she saw Jesus standing, and she did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said unto her then, woman, why do you weep? Whom do you seek? She, supposing him to be the gardener, said, sir, if you have borne him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away. So her expectation is still that he's dead. Now remember when we were reading in Mark's account that he mentioned that it was Mary Magdalene that Jesus first appeared to. It's John who is now filling in that blank and saying, and here's how it happened. Verse 16, Jesus said to her, Mary. She turned herself and said unto him, Rabboni, which is to say, Master. At that moment she recognized who he was, and he said, don't touch me, touch me not. For I am not yet ascended to my Father, but go to my brethren and say unto them, I ascend to my Father and your Father, and to my God and to your God. Mary Magdalene came and told the disciples that she had seen the Lord and that he had spoken these things unto her. So John fills in the blanks of how it is that Mary Magdalene became the first woman to see Jesus and was sent out to say he is risen. So all of those pieces start to fit together. Interestingly then, look at verse 24. After the 12 had gathered, verses 19 through 23 say that there had been a gathering of them, but Thomas, one of the 12 called Didymus, was not with them when Jesus came. The other disciples therefore said unto him, we have seen the Lord. But he said unto them, except I see in his hands the prints of the nails, and I put my finger in the print of the nails, and I thrust my hand into his side, I will not believe. And after 8 days again his disciples were within, and Thomas was with them this time. Then came Jesus, the doors being shut, and he stood in their midst and said, peace unto you, which means he appeared in their midst. And he said unto Thomas, reach hither thy finger, behold my hands, reach hither thy hand, thrust it into my side, be not faithless, but be believing. He said to Mary, don't touch me. I haven't been to my Father. 8 days later, he appears to Thomas and he says, touch me. Where'd he been?
To his Father.
He'd been to his Father. He had completed the transaction. He'd been to the holiest place in heaven. The Father had accepted the complete sacrifice. And then he was able to come back in a body, a resurrected body, that could go through a rock and go through a locked door. It was also just as comfortable standing in the holiest place in heaven. And part of the theology of the resurrection that we're developing here is that that's the kind of body we're destined to have. We do not know yet what will become of us. We know this, that when he appears, we will be like him. We know that we will be buried in corruption, raised in incorruption. We know that this mortal will put on immortality and this corruptible will put on incorruptibility. All of those promises are in the Bible that we are also going to one day have bodies that are as comfortable dwelling on earth, sitting by the seashore, and just as comfortable standing in the throne room of heaven. That's part of the promise that is the package of the resurrection. The fact that Jesus resurrected and carries that kind of body. It's interesting that he would even say to Thomas, you know, I'm not a spirit. I have flesh, I have bone, but I've risen, never to die again. And that's the kind of bodies we're going to have. We're going to either rise up out of our graves with those kind of bodies or be part of that instantaneous change that Paul says happens in an instant, in the twinkling of an eye, that we will put on this incorruption. And the older I get and the more corruptible this body gets, the more I enjoy that notion of being instantaneously changed to incorruptibility. Because nothing corruptible is going to stand before God. Nothing corruptible is going to enter into heaven. And we'll read that from 1 Corinthians when we get to it as we continue to develop now that we've got the details and the narration of what occurred. That event, that central event of all human history, the resurrection of Christ, led to all of the foundational doctrine that is Pauline Christianity. So there's a lot of theology of the resurrection now to talk about over the next couple of weeks. So you got all that? So does this make more sense now? I talked about it 2 weeks ago. This week we looked at all the scriptures about it and we filled in all the blanks. I'm just afraid that the Friday-Sunday scenario not only doesn't work, it can't work, and it isn't supported by scripture. So I prefer to just stand on the Bible and say, the Bible says this, and I'm not going to let the traditions of men get in the way of that. And you know what? On Good Friday, eat a steak. You're not undermining anything biblical by doing so. Any questions about that?
I have a question. Definition of evening. I suppose this could be the sun is still well up in the sky and still called evening.
That word evening is the even amount of dark and light. It's that period of time, we call it dusk. It's that period of time when there's an equal amount of dark and light, so it's even. And that's precisely where that word even came from, yep.
Because he must be in a real hurry here if at the evening when it's
no doubt
become full-blown sundown.
Right.
And he's just beginning to ask Pilate.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of work to do before that sun comes.
But if he could go inside the city and talk to Pilate and still get outside the city, get the body down and get it into the tomb, that gives you some idea how close to the city Golgotha and the tomb had to be.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. He had to be moving. Yeah. By the way, our word Lent, do you know where the word Lent comes from? Anybody here keeping Lent? Anybody following Lent? Do you give up anything? No? Okay. Because I would slap you around severely. But the word Lent comes from the word lengthen or lengthen. It moved into the English language as the word lengthen because it was the beginning of the lengthening of the days in the spring, that the days had gotten so short during the winter, and as the days became longer, they lengthened, and the Gaelic lengthened, and that became Lent, shortened to that. It all has to do with calendar days and days getting longer. So really, you're giving up broccoli because the days are longer and you have ashes on your forehead. They'll tell you you're keeping it for 40 days because Jesus was 40 days in the wilderness, but he wasn't 40 days in the wilderness and then to the cross. No, no, no. That whole scenario predates Christianity. There was 40 days of weeping over the death of Tammuz before the rebirth of the unconquerable sun every spring on the Ishtar feast. That all predates Christianity and then was brought during the 4th century as Constantinianism was reigning and Christianity became the state religion of Rome and all of these heathen practices were imposed onto Christianity. The entire Easter, Ishtar, Lenten, unconquerable sun go out on the first day that we can celebrate on Ishtar that the sun is coming out. It's a fertility feast. And so you have symbols of fertility. Let's see, what would be two good symbols of fertility? Oh yeah, rabbits and eggs. And we'll hide them for Jesus. I don't know what any of that means. I don't, you know, I have no idea. So, you know, it's coming up. I get the same feeling around Ishtar that I get around the Christ Mass. It just sort of depresses me because everywhere I go, there are all these symbols and emblems. I can't go in the grocery store without being hit with eggs and rabbits everywhere, and there's nobody paying attention to the reality of the full atoning propitiatory work of Christ and remembering that, but they sure do want to shove the Ishtar feast in your face everywhere you go. And I reach the point where, like, the last week before Easter actually hits, I'll barely come out of my house. It's just more than I can stand. And, so, and you think I'm kidding. I mean, it really appalls me. So don't worry about those traditions. You're not upsetting Christianity or the Bible or Jesus by negating those traditions. Instead, come here Resurrection Sunday and we'll keep the Lord's Supper together and we will talk about the finished atoning work of Christ, and that's a much better way to spend that morning. Okay? So I'll plan to see you here.
On behalf of everyone at Grace Christian Assembly, we thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. Remember to visit us on the internet at www.salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.